the prophecy has come true.
Yes.
I got not one, but two pairs of sweatpants.
Sweatpants?
Sweatpants.
Finally, this is legitimately a sweatpants tech pod.
I had a lot of like athletic pants, like track pants and stuff, but I didn't have any sweatpants before this Christmas.
Like, we're talking the, what is that material? Like a terry cloth, just the traditional stretchy, soft, like late 80s, early 90s kind of creepy sweatpants.
So, I mean, there's a drawstring. The legs are slightly tapered with a little bit of an elastic at the cuff.
Okay. Those are, that sounds very sweatpantsy.
I got two pairs. Gina and the kiddo got me the post game jogger from Fabletics, which is a fair pair of fancy ass sweatpants.
Okay.
And they're very comfortable. They're snug. I would actually wear these out. Probably they have pockets. Really? So you could put a wallet and keys in, perhaps.
Okay.
The other pair, though, are the coziest pants I've ever owned. This is not like a paid promotional bit or anything, by the way. Just so you know.
Important to clarify.
One of my mods at the Twitch community had recommended these Uniqlo fleece-lined, pile-lined sweatpants is what they're called. And they have like fleecy stuff inside the sweatpants.
Okay.
So it's like double insulation, and they are the coziest pants I've ever owned.
I mean, Uniqlo is fancy enough that I don't even know if you can call them sweatpants, right? Like, they need some kind of slightly trendier. Oh no, he's standing up to show off. Are you wearing them right now?
Fuck yeah, I'm wearing them right now.
Okay. Do those look nicer than, I don't know that I'd call those sweatpants.
They're,
I
mean, sweatpants, I guess
technically they're sweatpants.
There's no structure to the waist. There's no belt loops.
Okay. All right.
The pockets are fleece lined and they're cozy and warm. And
but I mean, are they intended to be worn around the house? That's the question.
I think the primary intention
behind the gift that you would lounge in these in your home, because if that's the case, I'm all for it.
Where else am I going to, like, there's nowhere else I would want to be. Oh, well, there's a million places I would want to be right now, but there's nowhere else I'm going for at least the next 6 months.
Extenuating circumstances aside, let's say, would these be out of doors pants or not?
I would push the garbage in and out in these. Like, okay. I would embrace the neighborhood. Yes, I would probably not go to the grocery store.
That's about the perfect, I would say, margin for sweatpants to exist in.
Yeah, like when we used to get the paper, the paper with these.
No farther than 50 feet from your house.
If I was going out to pick up breakfast or lunch and I was going someplace that had a drive-through, I would wear these. But if I had to go into the store, I would wear the other ones.
Do you think our Twitter handle is limiting our reach?
Maybe, but the other good ones, like, we would have to put a lot of underscores to get anything else even approaching on brand.
That's true. I had to look it up to confirm. It's at Sweatpants Tech.
Yeah, that's it. It's a very active Twitter account. I look at it at least once a week.
We have been highly authentic to our Twitter brand until now.
Look, we were thought leaders before the 2020 pandemic landed and everybody became about sweatpants.
That's true.
Not just us.
I have to confess, if I were being true to form, it would be at Gym Shorts Tech.
Yeah, Athletic Shorts.
At Athletic Shorts Tech.
You have a deep well of athletic shorts, I'm going to say.
Yes, that's it. They're like sweatpants, except half as long.
See, but you live in an apartment.
We have to workshop that one a little bit more.
Look, you live in an apartment, so you're insulated on three sides because you have people above you too, right?
Yes.
See, in our house, we have no insulation on three sides. Okay. So it's cold here
drafty.
All the time.
A little drafty.
Okay. Yeah, it's a breezy house. I looked at those. You can get those like cling film insulating plastic windows to put inside your windows for people who live in like places that it gets actually cold, like Minnesota. So you make another pocket of air inside your triple pane windows.
Ooh.
But I was going to get those for here since we just have single pane windows in a lot of our house because, you know, the people who built our house in the 50s were a-holes. So, well, anyway,
you have to strike back at them from 2020.
Yeah.
Around here, you wear the pants you want. That's the Tech Pod promise.
We'll be right back.
Welcome to Brad and Will Made a Tech Pod. I'm Will.
I'm Brad.
Brad.
Hello.
The year
is 2021.
Night. Oh, sorry. Oh, yeah. Happy New Year.
I didn't know where you were going with that.
Happy New Year, man.
Hello. Hi. Happy New Year to you and all.
Did you celebrate? Did you stay up late?
You and your friend? I was technically awake at midnight. Yes.
Whoa. Like,
barely.
That's unusual. Like,
half awake on the couch, let's say.
Okay.
I wouldn't say I was celebrating or anything.
We did. We played some games with some friends and then watched the ball drop on the East Coast and then signed off and we're like, did some stuff with the kiddo. And I spent, let's say, 3 or 4 hours yesterday on our Animal Crossing island, making a gigantic scavenger hunt, thinking that she and some of her friends would come over and they'd go dig. Like, I buried gold nuggets and
that's fun.
You know, all sorts of good costume stuff and some winter festival things and all that. And I built an incredibly elaborate, like, gnome. I've been collecting gnome statues for about 6 months to do this. Not this particular day, but like, I wanted to do a scavenger hunt with the gnomes because the gnomes all stand there and they point forward.
Oh, those gnomes. Like, yes, right.
I'll have a series of gnome statues that point and you follow the path. And it'll be like a Zelda maze where you have to like follow the statue maze and you get to the end. There's red herrings everywhere. I buried a bazillion like little bits of garbage, like wasp's nests and pieces of clay and sticks. Okay.
The more work you talk about putting into this, the more I suspect there's going to be a twist ending to the story.
So the twist ending is the kids got there last night. I was like, okay, it's time to start the scavenger hunt. They're like, okay, is it buried stuff? And I was like, yeah, it's all buried. And they were like, okay. And then instead of following the gnomes or any of the hints that I gave, they just dug up every X on the island with incredible thoroughness. Like, they got in all the places that I'd built the good hiding zones and everything. And they found everything in like 45 seconds. It was done.
It's because we don't care about your rules, Dad.
Yeah.
We play Animal Crossing the way we want.
That's what you get for trying. That's the lesson. Happy 2021.
That's right. Yes. Anything goes in this. I started to say in this new decade, but let's not get into that argument. I am not one of those. The decade starts at 2021 or whatever type people.
Oh, yeah. Because 2000 is the 10th 90.
Right.
10 is,
I am not part of the, you know, 2000 is technically part of the 20th century crowd.
But it is, that is correct, though.
It's not
the 2000th year.
It's not worth it, is what I'm saying. I understand the technical argument.
Okay, I have a real question for you, then. If the Enterprise and the Super Star Destroyer Executor fought, who would win?
Okay, well, if the Enterprise was able to blow up the shield generators next to the conning tower, then I think it would level the playing field pretty significantly.
They're just deflectors. They're not even real shields. It's baby shields for babies.
The Enterprise. Ion cannons do not interact with the Enterprise's shields. This is all I have. I don't know.
Primitive snub fighters, Brad.
I don't have an answer.
Picard even answers this when the primitives come after them. It's a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away. It's primitive technology.
Just roll up with a mass driver and destroy both of them, because just throw a rock at them at a significant portion of the speed of light and the whole conversation will be over.
Just teleport out, you know, you fire up the transporter but send a little antimatter over there. Do they even have spacesuits in Star Wars? I don't think I've ever seen anybody wear a spacesuit except for like a weird alien here and there.
No, I don't think they do. Like, there's that whole weird bit in Empire Strikes Back where they're on that asteroid just kind of walking around in a cave with nothing.
Yeah.
The
collection that Gary and Austin wrote for, the short story collection, has a very good space worm story in it that I can't remember who wrote. Okay. It explains the problems with that, with the mask in space.
I increasingly am of the opinion that Star Wars is just Arthurian legend in space.
Yeah, that seems right.
That it is not worth dissecting the technical or scientific aspects.
Absolutely correct. It's magic.
Yes.
It's just magic.
Yes. It's fucking knights and wizards running around with swords and magic. Come on.
You know, speaking of Star Wars, I remember a time when I was a youth, about 10 years old. And I remember thinking, oh, man, Return of the Jedi came out 2 years ago. They haven't said anything about a new one. So I guess that's it for Star Wars, because Darth Vader's dead. The whole thing's over, right? Huh. The year was 1985, Brad. Careless Whisper by Wham was the number one pop single of the year.
Return of the Jedi came out in 1983.
Yep. Back to the Future led the box office.
God, did that come out in 85? Man, I feel old.
Nintendo had just released a limited batch of the U.S. version of their Famicom system.
You know what? I'm sorry. I hate to backpedal for a second, but yeah. I actually watched like 20 minutes of Return of the Jedi last night randomly. Yeah.
Wow.
Because I like to party around here.
Pretty good. It's a pretty good movie.
But it happened to be the part right in the middle between the Tatooine part and the kind of intercut, you know, like Ewoks slash throne room slash space battle, like big finale.
Yeah.
It was the lull in the middle.
Like the Dagobah slash spaceship.
It was literally after the Dagobah stuff, just the we're meeting around the Falcon, this like ugly matte painting of the Falcon. And we're on the desert. I mean, not the desert, the jungle planet.
Yeah.
And stuff like the really dull part. And I feel like I saw some shades of the prequels in there. I was sort of starting to see, it's like, okay, here is, as Lucas was making more money and kind of getting more unilateral control over all of this, like the tone and the presentation of it all. I was like, parts of this sort of remind me of the, you know what I mean? Just like the cadence of the delivery and the editing and stuff. I was like, this feels a little prequel-like in this part.
So the knock, there's a through line through all of those movies up until the post-sequel, I think. And the through line through the Lucas ones is very clear, because like at the point that Return of the Jedi was made, they were making so much money on toys that really the movie didn't matter at all. And the only reason he stopped making movies was because he owned the rights to them. And he was like, I don't want to do this anymore. Even though the toys make a lot of money, I'm probably good.
Well, it also almost killed him. Like he ended up in the hospital with cardiovascular problems.
Yeah.
That's apparently why he decided to cut it off at 3.
Yeah, that makes sense. So I mean, we didn't get to see what the wills looked like, I guess.
Oh, man.
I've been in the theater where he edited Return of the Jedi. It's the original THX theater up in San Rafael.
On the ranch or?
No. It's at what used to be Kerner Studios, which is 3210 or 3810 or something like that. You can rent the studio. It's like 600, 800 bucks, something. It's not expensive.
By theater and by editing, do you mean it's like a tiny, like working theater? Or it's not like a presentation theater.
It's like a private theater. The theater probably where they showed dailies and stuff for the effects reels. Because it's where the effects shop was.
Okay. Because you edited in like an editing bay back then, right?
Well, so the theater had editing bay hook-ins so they could hook up an Avid or whatever the toaster, video toaster, whatever it was at the time.
Do you want to? I'm trying to figure out how many minutes into this episode we are. Do you want to just talk about Lucasfilm for this episode?
I don't think I know enough about Luke. I know people who know enough about Lucasfilm that we could do that episode in the future, but
I'd absolutely want to sign up for that. I feel like we're right on the cusp of either not having a time for our stated topic.
Oh, no, we got to talk about the stated topic. I'm very excited about this.
Okay, let's table this Lucasfilm stuff, because I would love to. If you know somebody that we get on here to really talk about that stuff, then
we can make that happen.
We should really make that happen. But
it's 1985. The year is 1985. Careless Whisper by Wham is running up the charts. Uh-huh. Back to the Future is the number one movie in theaters. And Nintendo just released a limited batch of the U.S. version of their Famicom home entertainment system.
What's it going to be called?
It's called NES. It's the Nintendo Entertainment. It turned out to be the most important console of all time, probably.
I should check that out.
They just rolled out like a few hundred to Sears, and they didn't really tell anybody because everybody was really skittish after, you know, Atari fucked up the whole thing.
The fabled test market.
Computer Chronicles is entering its fourth season.
Is it?
So it's about to.
Just to set this up, I guess this is an episode dictated by algorithm.
So,
because I was on YouTube the other day. and the YouTube algorithm decided to serve me up an episode of the Computer Chronicles in my sidebar entitled Hard Disk Storage 1985. And so I clicked on it and watched it.
And you sent it to me and you were like, dude, you have to watch this right now.
It's just like, what do you think? Well, I mean, that goes for every Computer Chronicles episode. In fact, like I'm trying to think of what the Computer Chronicles law is. There is a I'm trying to work this out in my head. There's an inverse relationship between the newness of a Computer Chronicles episode and the dude, you have to watch this-ness of it. Like the older it is, the more it's like, dude, look at this.
Yeah. So we talked about doing, I think we're going to try to do this more regularly because it's kind of fun, but, yeah. But like, this is the first episode of Computer Chronicles where they were talking about hard drive technologies, and like the hard drive at this point for a personal computer, meaning a small, before hard drives got personal computer size, they were like the size of a washing machine with yes. huge spinning disks in them. And it was like an industrial thing that had to be moved in on a forklift.
Yes. That's actually one of the things I wrote down in my notes here, but just real quick, more broadly, we might serialize this idea if people like it, or if people hate this is probably the only time we'll do it. But like the idea is basically like all these episodes are on YouTube and archive.org. So we'll put the YouTube link to this episode in the show notes. And if you want, you maybe might work better to watch it before you listen to the rest of the episode I don't know.
I mean, I think we'll give it, I'm going to endeavor to give enough context so you know what we're talking about.
Sure. Yeah. Yes, I guess. Yes. Actually, now that you mentioned it, ideally this works as a standalone podcast without forcing somebody to watch a 30 minute
yeah.
TV show. But the idea is basically just like, hey, let's go back and watch this crazy time capsule of PC tech and kind of run through it.
Yeah. And I think we might do it. We might try it with magazines too. Because yes, there's a bunch of old computer magazines on archive.org. And
you reminded me that I had completely forgotten. You had this idea like 6 months ago that we would do this with like issues of Byte and stuff like that.
Byte and computer shopper and yes, PC like and Max PC. Yeah, go back to
PC Week.
Yeah.
And stuff like that. But we kind of ended up just doing this Computer Chronicles version first.
I think the Computer Chronicles one, this one is too good. So the topic is hard drives. Hard disk storage is what it's called. It's from December 17th, 1985 is the first air date. And we have a link in the show notes for real. We usually say we do that and then forget to do it. And then, but so they're talking about, there's a way that people who talk about technology, and I know we do this too, talk about stuff that's new that is like default a little skeptical to here's all of the ways that things that are similar to this have gone bad in the past. Mm-hmm. And this is the earliest representation of this. Cause like Stuart, I think it's Chaffee. I don't know.
Stuart Chaffee is the host. Yeah.
Yeah. Talks at the beginning about hard drives as like a hard drive is for me. Like I got my first computer that was mine in like 1993, I guess, 92. And for me, that machine came with a hard drive. The stuff from the early 80s that didn't have hard drives, that basically worked off the floppy drives like Apple IIs and IBM XTs and IBM PCs and stuff like that were before my time for all intents and purposes. So it's yeah. really fun to have this, to watch this conversation of a guy who is deeply skeptical of this emerging technology, yes. the hard disk drive.
Yeah. To put it in context, the 10 megabytes is the entry level hard drive talked about in this episode.
And I don't think they gave prices, did they?
They did talk prices for some of the kind of external backup systems and they mentioned $395 as a price point for something. But again, some of these hard drives were sort of included in backup systems yeah. that were adding to the price there. But it was, I think he said $1,000 a year prior had been the cost of a 10 megabyte hard drive.
Yeah, that seems right.
But yes, you're right. Like they do not absolutely treat the hard drive as an essential part of the personal computer. they are constantly questioning the people they bring on in the context of like, what would a home user do with this much space? Like, what are some, like, they literally ask the question like four or five times in different ways. Like, what are some of the applications you can do now that you have this much space? And like the hard drive makers don't really have an answer. It's like, store a bigger database, of course.
You can copy your database, keep a backup copy of your database.
Yeah. Like, I mean, obviously this is very primitive in home computing terms, but like they don't even have like multimedia oriented answers because there kind of was no like desktop publishing industry at that point yet. Like they weren't quite there, right?
It was 1980. Like, yeah. I mean, at this point, so at my parents' business in 1985, the only person that had a computer on their desk was the person who did inventory stuff. And I think that was just so they could print out the inventory sheets, not that they were keeping the inventory on the computer.
Yes.
Because it was like viewed as unreliable.
finally, toward the end of the episode, one of the guys that they brought on that makes, or from a company that makes the hard drives, came up with something of an answer to that question, which was basically like, well, say you're doing cache management for your company. Now you won't have to access the mainframe to use that application because you can store the cache management application on your personal computer. Like, well, that was the best. That was the best he could come up with, was like, ah, you can balance a budget more easily with this.
Well, and at that point too, you're talking about a pretty big company if they have like a mini computer or a mainframe or something like that, like a small VAX or whatever.
Yeah, VAX is what they mentioned specifically.
It's the other thing that was shocking about this to me, and I had forgotten about this. This is from a period of time when the personal computer market was very fragmented still.
Yeah.
In that, like, you would buy, if you bought a computer from the wrong company, you'd have a different operating system. Totally. And wouldn't work with the one that you bought from IBM or whatever.
Yeah. And this was about, I'd say 70-80% focused on the IBM AT and XT, but then they had like sort of, here's our Macintosh segment because that's separate. And then I don't think they got into any other companies' systems on this one.
They didn't talk about other company systems on this one, except they did. There were some news things, but the thing that they did do, like this, at other episodes from this time period, they would have talked about other like Tandy color computers and stuff like that. I would think.
Right.
The XT was such a monolith at this point that like they were reporting on price decreases and increases of that manufacturer's personal computer. Right. Not like, it wasn't like, hey, the Intel CPU in this is going to be reduced in price by 20%. So the price of your personal computer is going to go down. It's like IBM is thinking about decreasing the price by 20% of this computer, which is just like, and the competitor for these newfangled hard disk drives was the IBM, what do they call it? The hard card?
Yes, the hard card.
I had to look that up. It's an expansion card for IBM XTs, which like they didn't have an IDE or I mean, obviously they didn't have SATA, but they didn't have any kind of IDE bus on those computers. So in order to add permanent storage, you put a card in a slot. And on that slot was mounted a hard disk platters and IO heads.
That was the sales pitch that the guy gave. Was, I guess there were other ways to get a hard drive into a PC at that point, but it required like a technician to install and that kind of thing. And this is literally, if you want to envision it, it's just like an expansion card like you would put in any PC, long enough to also have a hard drive bolted onto it.
Well, and it had both the power supply and the data interface on that on that card.
Right.
And these are XT cards. These are pre-ISA.
I was going to ask if that, okay, that I didn't know when ISA came about.
So ISA started around, like the first computer I had with ISA slots was a 386 probably.
Okay.
And I don't think I ever opened up that because I inherited, like one of my uncles replaced all the computers with PC Juniors at his office, XTs with PC Juniors. And the XTs he gave to family members or sold them to everybody for like $100 a piece or something. So we ended up with an XT in like 19 around this time, probably.
Okay.
And I didn't like, you couldn't do anything with it. It was like we had a couple of pirated versions of like MicroProse simulator games, like M1 Tank Platoon, M1A1 Tank Platoon and stuff like that. And that was pretty much it. Like I tried word processing, but we didn't have a printer. So like writing a paper on it just meant that you then had this thing in the computer that you couldn't do anything with. So there was no reason to even learn how to type. I never even opened that case, I guess is what I'm saying. Like I never saw what the inside of that computer looked like. It's the only computer I've ever owned that I didn't take apart.
So this was, I don't mean to get too far afield of the topic here, but I guess this must have been like directly before Compaq kicked off the kind of clone revolution. Is that right?
It was probably a little bit I mean, HP and Compaq were definitely getting ready to get into that market. It didn't become a big deal until the early 90s.
Okay.
Like Windows 3.1 was when people started having computers in their home that were Windows computers in my, like DOS 5 and Windows 3.0 were when that stuff started happening. It really wasn't until 3.1.
Okay.
And the DX processors, okay. The 486.
Yeah, I mean, specifically, I'm thinking about the transition from IBM being the whole market to IBM compatible becoming the market, you know?
Yeah, I mean, at this point, these were still phenomenally expensive devices, too. Yeah. Like an IBM XT was probably a $3,000 computer new.
Yeah, they mentioned at one point in this episode, like the cheapest personal computer you can get on the market at this point is like $1,500. And that's, you know, again, that's $1,500 in 1985 dollars.
Yeah. So like you're looking at like used car money, like nice used car money for a good PC at that time.
Right.
You get a Cadillac or a PC, you choose.
Yeah. Like talking about that skepticism at the beginning where they were like, do people really need these things? I thought it was funny that the co-host Gary Kildall, which first of all, I was like, every time I watch the Computer Chronicles and he's on there, I'm like, why does that name sound so familiar? And I started to Google him and I was like, oh, he is the author of CPM, which
was
kind of, it's a very old, was it 8086 compatible or IBM compatible? I don't know on what level it was. It's an operating system. I don't know.
It was a disk operating system that wasn't MS-DOS.
Right. But I don't know on what level it was compatible. Like, I don't know if it was specifically an IBM thing or if it ran on any 8086 machine. I'm not clear on. Anyway, the point is CPM is like in some ways the basis of DOS. And anyway, he got around and did other stuff, including this show at the same time. Like, obviously a pretty important figure in computing history.
Yeah, it seemed like they wrote CPM for pretty much everything that you could run that you would need that for. Like,
right.
This is the other weird thing about this time is when IBM shipped the PC, they shipped it without an OS. So you had to buy an OS as an option. Which I don't know if that was like because they just assumed people were going to pirate their OSs. I don't understand why you like that computer would be useless without a way to read disks.
I just assumed the business model had not been fully hammered out yet, and like the operating system, I would guess like IBM probably saw the market as a hardware commodity market, right? Like software was an afterthought, right? It's like you're in the business of selling hardware, right?
Yeah.
And like what you do with it is up to you. You need to go get your own operating system, figure that out yourself. And like stuff like this, you know, like single individual people were out there writing operating systems for the stuff and selling it at this point.
So yeah, making like millions of dollars selling disk, like literally a piece of software to read and write from disks.
Yeah. Anyway, like he's kind of the dry, technically minded counterpart to Stuart Chaffee's like very hosty kind of persona.
But so Stuart is a technical guy too.
Oh, he totally is. Yeah. He totally is. But he's got the host voice, and
oh yeah,
Gary is much more just like over here rattling off tech facts all the time. But anyway, he brought up. I laughed because like practically the first thing he said about hard drives was his concern about all the mechanical problems that come along with a spinning disk.
Yep.
Such as ball bearings wearing out or head crashes or like all the other mechanical problems that can happen with that sort of thing. And it's like I was just like, oh, you mean all the things that we still worry about with hard drives?
Yeah.
You know,
well, I feel like bearings wearing out is less of a problem these days.
That one less so, but still like mechanical failure is still a constant fear with hard drives, right? 35 years later, like it seems like that's never going away.
I mean, I think the lesson of the last 10 years for me with the shift to SSDs even is that we're just going to shift one way of failing for another new way of failing.
Yeah. Yeah. Like I remember when SSDs came out, I was like, oh, thank God, no more mechanical failure. And now it's like, oh, these lose data if they're not powered for more than like a year and they can only be written to so many times and then they're useless. It's like, okay, great. This nothing is perfect.
Did you ever go to a computer show in this time frame?
No. So we didn't. I mean, my family didn't get a computer until 94, I think, is the year.
Okay. So
we were pretty late in the game. Like ISA was the legacy slot by the time we got a computer. Like our first computer had a Visa local bus slot in it.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah, okay. we were a year off from Pentiums or less, I think, by the time
we got in. Yeah, you were almost to PCI time by that point.
Yeah.
Probably into PCI time by that point. So I went to my dad and I went to a computer show at the VFW hall in Bristol when I was probably a few years after this. It was probably like late 80s, early 90s, but it was before we bought the Wang. And it was like a gym. It was a big ballroom type gym with like hardwood floors, like dancing floors. And there were just a bunch of 6-foot folding tables and guys that were dressed just like these guys on TV.
Yeah.
Like bearded computer nerds wearing beige suits and with like tubs with Ziploc bags full of software. So like the Ziploc bags and this wasn't like this wasn't pirated software. It was just like, they made their software. They put the floppies in a Ziploc with an instruction manual. And then they had a label printer that would print the label on the front of the Ziploc bag. And they were always weird shaped Ziplocs. They were like tall, skinny, like almost like comic book packing bags, like comic book size. So they were vertical oriented. They would fit 3.5, or you could usually get it on 3.5 for 5.25 discs. Probably 5.25 discs at that point would be my guess.
Yes.
It was a weird time.
Very grassroots. Like that, I mean, that to me is like a whole vibe or aesthetic, I would say, at this point of like that early. Like I wrote that down in the notes when I was watching this of what I wrote verbatim is the show is so squarely situated in the era of pocket protectors and business suits and beige everything.
There was
no culture or style in computing whatsoever back then. It was purely just a bunch of engineers and business people running the entire thing, you know, like the era of the, like, you know, the programmer, like the more recent kind of like jock sort of takeover of the tech industry was just like unheard of at that point. You know, it was purely nerds all the way down.
Well, I mean, I feel like there was probably a fair amount of substance abuse at this time.
Oh, sure. Yeah, of course. I mean, that'll happen anywhere. I mean,
but
you know, like you look at this and it's just it's chronically terminally uncool. Right. But but it's cool because of that to me. Like, I love that whole vibe, you know, like all the companies are just named like Plus Developments and Priam and like just. You know, everything is like named by engineers and like designed by engineers. You know what I mean?
And the logos are all like a series of horizontal lines in different arrangements and color patterns. And yeah.
But again, we touched on it before. Like, what are the applications that you could use a computer for back then on a small scale? It was like balancing your budget and like running payroll and stuff like that. You know, it was not any of the cool stuff that people use computers for now.
Well, they played games, Brad.
That's true.
One of the things that's fascinating to me about this show at this time period is that like this is these computers are it's pro- I guess you could open up IBM PCs, but like there's even a segment in the Mac in the what's going on with hard drives on Mac where they're talking about a product that you can add to the Macintosh or to the Apple II. It's pre Macintosh.
Oh, well, I thought it was the Mac that was they were talking about. Yeah, it's got a screen built into it, so that had to be. In fact, they showed the GUI as well. So yes.
Okay. So
it was the original Mac. It was like the original black and white Mac, though.
The
it was
vertical the first one, right?
The HyperDrive is the name of the product.
Yeah. So the HyperDrive is the first product that Apple allows you to add to your Mac,
like third party, right?
Third
like
party, yeah.
Without the warranty.
Yeah. Which is like the idea that opening your computer could void the warranty. I remember it's Compaq and some of the other low end OEMs tried to get that eMachines. And some of those guys tried to do the sticker thing where they would put the sticker on and say like, you know, removing the sticker voids your warranty or stuff like that. And the courts threw all that stuff out. But at this period of time, we were a long way from even challenging that. So like the fact that there's an episode of this show about add-ins from a time when you couldn't really like there was no provision for adding in outside of it. Like, it's not like those IBM slots were industry standard. They were just whatever the IBM engineers wanted to do to add stuff to the computer that they could sell as an add-on later. Like there's no ecosystem at this point. It's just a series of computers that you can buy and maybe screw some stuff into.
Just like just bespoke kind of one-off add-ons, right? And like stuff that people are coming up with and selling on their own, but it's not some institutionalized like, oh, here, this is the standard slot that you design against and blah, blah, blah. It's like they pointed out, excuse me, that HyperDrive still took like an hour to install by a technician. Like you couldn't just buy it and do it yourself. Like you had to get somebody to do it. Also, I just pulled it up on Wikipedia and that HyperDrive was $2,795.
And 10 megs?
10. So... yeah, it's a 10 megabyte hard drive. I'm trying to find. They talked about it as if it had more than a hard drive in it.
It has power supply and disk controller too. Yeah.
Disk controller. Okay. I thought they talked almost like it added more memory or something as well, but I'm not seeing that here. No, I guess you're right. I guess it is just a hard drive.
It might have had more memory in the form of cache, which they maybe wouldn't have known what to deal with it, at that point.
It says that Wikipedia says that it had to plug directly into the 68,000 processor socket.
Yeah.
But whatever that means. So
yeah, it's just sure. The whole thing is bonkers.
Yeah. Like it's crazy that they were coming up with stuff like that. Well, life finds a way. Data finds a way.
Well, so they were talking about 10 and 20 meg disks.
Yeah. Up so to 60, give, like the 60 little, is the and, biggest they mentioned on this episode. But
well,
that's
these are what would you call this? This is like a full height. So like a CD-ROM drive that you're familiar with, the thing which is probably the biggest 5.25-inch thing most people are familiar with. I think a CD-ROM drive is a 1/4 height slot technically.
True. Okay.
Because I feel like these drives are either three or four CD-ROM drives tall.
They take one apart in the episode and it is tall. It is a chonky box.
Yeah, it's a big boy. They explicitly have to state, hey, we opened this one up so you can see what it looks like on the inside, but you shouldn't do this because if you do this, it'll destroy the hardware, which is really funny. Because like everybody knows, don't open your hard drive because the magic gets out. But also, damn.
Yeah. But then they kind of went into detail about why. Like, I'm shocked. Like, I know this was on public television and computing was dominated by technically minded people back then. But I'm still like shocked at how much detail they go into on this show. Like, they're talking about RAM at the beginning in the intro, and like Kildall just mentions like, oh, you're not going to see RAM expansion cards once we get to 32-bit processors because the address space is so big. It's like, I can't believe you're talking about memory addressing in the intro of this like ostensibly like public facing show. You know what I mean? Like, what audience is this playing to that you're talking about stuff like that? You know, they get into clean rooms and like the vacuum effect inside the hard disk and what causes head crashes and like the Bernoulli effect, which we'll get to. Like, it's just it's super engineering heavy.
It almost feels like they made a TV show that's for like CTOs.
Kind of. Sure. Yeah.
Or burgeoning CTOs at that point, because probably CTO wasn't a defined job really then.
And they're like system designers and builders and stuff like that. Right.
Yeah.
Like the people that were like hands on making this hardware.
I mean, I wonder if this was still shot out in the down in the valley where I assume it was, in just like a little studio on the side of 101 on the side of El Camino Real, I guess. Anyway, it was really fun to go back and watch this. The time also is good. I think he talks about spending 10 minutes to back up 15 minutes to back up 10 megabytes.
Yeah, I think that's right.
It was really funny because this morning in the TechPod Discord, somebody was talking about, I want to get the actual quote because it was really good. It is. They're talking about going to the store because they needed a micro SD card for a Pi Zero. So they just went to Micro Center and picked one up and got an energy drink at the same time. And the energy drink was more expensive than the micro SD card, which probably, I mean, I'm guessing the micro SD card was like a 16 or 32 gig one.
Right.
So it's five orders of magnitude or something bigger. Say,
like, how many tens of thousands of times bigger is this thing the size of your pinky fingernail?
Three orders of magnitude, mega, giga, tera. Yeah. Anyway. But yeah. And costs less than the energy drink.
Right. Like, you might as well buy it at the side of the cash register at a gas station or something at that point, right? Like, it's nothing.
Yeah, I mean,
like, they ask one of the product designers, and like, I know just like how far we've come is like the most cliched observation ever, but like, they asked the guy that was like, you know, how far do you see this going? Like, what are the limits on what hard drive technology and storage capacity are going to do in the future based on what you've seen? And he's like, the limits are functionally limitless, you know, like, or, you know, infinite. Like, there's no ceiling on where this can go. And like, you know, sure enough, a 14 terabyte hard drive is pretty cheap these days.
Well, there's a moment in this episode where they have like the editorial guy, like the opinion guy come on.
Oh my God. I wasn't sure how to bring this into it. Is this the orange turtleneck guy?
This is the orange turtleneck guy. I don't remember what his name is.
I'm pulling this out of my head. George Morrow, I want to say. I think that's right.
Likely.
I'll double check. He's definitely positioned as the Andy Rooney of this show.
Yes.
Like, they bring him in at the end to opine about the topic after they've gone through all the technical stuff. And he kind of delivers what, like this, like this screed about we should be more thankful to hard drive designers. He's almost got like a chip on his shoulder toward the editors of like PC Week or Byte or whatever.
Because he's
talking about, like, some editor at Byte is just going to drop your product from a foot in the air and then say that it doesn't work anymore. And like, we don't appreciate your hard work enough.
See, I assumed he was an editor at Byte and that was a thing that actually happened.
But I would guess. I mean, let me check. Yes, George Morrow is his name.
Yeah, George Morrow.
The turtleneck just comes out of nowhere, man. But he also talking about hard drive design. He uttered a phrase so mind-blowing that I had to write it down in the notes. He's talking about operating in the treacherous world of magnetic flux.
Yeah, that seems right.
Yeah.
I mean, look, this is a conversation. The things that he's talking about here with like the using the magnets that float tiny space over the hard drive head to turn physical bits on the hard drive platters so that you can store data there is something that like I have had that same conversation in 5 or 10 year increments with hard drive. Like when HGST started rolling out their glass platters that debuted in the IBM 75 GXP Death Star, which we don't need to talk about, but they were talking about the same thing. Like this is the challenge. And the only thing that has changed is how small they can make the bits and how tightly they can jam them on the platters.
Which they grilled one of the designers in this episode about that very thing of just like, hey, what do you need to do? Like, what is the development process to make these things hold more data besides adding more platters? And they said exactly that, like, you know, pack more tracks onto the platter, pack more bits into the tracks, stuff like that. But then the immediate reaction was like, isn't that just going to make them less reliable to make everything smaller and denser? And they didn't have a good answer for that.
George Morrow is another CPM person.
Really?
Okay. But he is, according to Wikipedia, he was part of the Homebrew Computer Club, and he improved the S100 bus used in many early microcomputers.
Okay. All right.
So, like, it's a who's who, this show.
I was going to say, like, that turtleneck really threw me off. It sounds like he really, PhD in mathematics at Berkeley. Or looks like he washed out of that program. But yes, like, you know, I thought he was just some kind of a pundit sort of critic of the industry, but it sounds like he was really in it.
No, I think, a lot of these guys were the people who were in that world. Because Homebrew Computer Club is what HP and Apple and, you know, all of the Valley, the big Valley giants, Compaq, all that spun. Totally. I don't know about Compaq,
like,
but HP.
Like Wozniak was involved with that, right?
Wozniak and Jobs were like showed their first Apple computer at the Homebrew Computer Club meeting.
Right. It's fun. I don't know how I got into this habit. It's fun watching this show off and on. And just like every time they bring a presenter on with a product from the 80s, like Googling their name and seeing how many of them are listed as like, you know, Silicon Valley angel investors now and stuff like that. Like a lot of them are involved with like, you know, startup incubators and sort of they're like the old guard or the elder statesman of the tech world, right?
It turns out, the people who were doing this, I would love to know who was funding Computer Chronicles. Oh, it actually says at the end, of course, because it's 80s PBS.
Yeah, it's PBS, so it's Light. It's all sponsored by different.
Or funded by a generous grant from.
Yes. Yes. It's definitely brought to you by. It's definitely one of those.
Yeah, that's really cool. Do we want to talk about the iOmega guy?
Yeah, that was kind of the last big topic here that I wanted to talk about was, well, it's kind of two things. They talked to an iOmega guy at a computer show, like out in the field.
At Comdex.
Was that Comdex?
That was Comdex.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
1985 Comdex. Also, as an aside, if you go back and watch that segment again, I feel like that guy has a real Texas oil man kind of accent. Except he's shilling like magneto optical removable storage disks or whatever those are.
Look, what were the centers of computing in the US at that time? Dallas, where Texas Instruments was,
right.
And the people that spun out of that.
Totally.
It was Boston, where Wang and DC and all that stuff were. It was Northern California. And I'm sure there were other people, other places, but it seemed like those were the like you had three types of computer nerds back in 1985.
Right.
Turtleneck wearing California boys.
Yeah.
You know, your Texas used car slash computer salesman.
Yeah, 10-gallon hat guys.
Yeah.
He definitely seems like one of those.
And then the MIT eggheads from Boston.
But so this introduced me to multiple concepts here, which was, first of all, the product they were showing off seems like it was basically the precursor to the zip drive. Is that right?
I mean,
like it was a giant removable storage cartridge kind of thing that they were showing off.
Yeah, it was a hard drive ish capacity device that didn't have read write heads in the cartridge that had a mechanism that lined those up with the platter when you put them in and somehow kept the platter from getting dusty and ruined.
which I guess relies on the Bernoulli principle. Is that correct?
So
what can you tell me about? So 19th century, I'm pulling this out of thin air. Swedish mathematician, is that right, Bernoulli?
Yeah.
So Swiss? I forget.
So Bernoulli was a scientist before there were specializations, I guess. We need to do a correction at the end of the episode from last week also, because I made a mistake last week.
18th century.
Huh?
Sorry, we're all over the place with corrections here. 18th century.
18th century, yeah.
If this is the Bernoulli that we're talking about.
So I think that the Bernoulli, they don't explicitly say, but my understanding is that the Bernoulli principle in this case uses the spinning motion, the air that moves around the disc when the disc is spinning, to create, to keep the head at the right spot, yeah, above that, to pull the disc toward the head without letting it crash into the head, basically.
That's what I got out of this, was that it was using some kind of passive air pressure effect to keep the rebrite head oriented properly.
So I thought that was how all hard drives work. Maybe they don't. Because, I mean, the Bernoulli effect, when the drives are spinning as fast as they do in a modern hard drive, is going to, like, the Bernoulli effect is also what makes wings work, right? So, like, a wing is humped on the top edge and flat on the bottom edge, and the air, because it's a fluid going over it, creates lift pushing down, because the air on the bottom goes slower than the air on the top. And so the air on the top gets less dense, and it pushes the wing up. And the same thing's happening inside here, is my understanding, but I don't know for sure.
Is it possible that they have adapted modern hard drives to also use this? Because that's part of his big sales pitch here, is that, like, our system, I forget what this product is called, but it was like, our system is immune to head crashes like in a normal hard drive because we use the Bernoulli effect. This is a Bernoulli box. We all know
that that's a lie. Like, the head crash is universal and inevitable if you run your drives long enough.
It was definitely a very competitive thing of, like, those hard drives, I don't know about those. We've got this thing figured out over here. You should probably get our removable thing instead. Also, they use the term Winchester drive to refer to hard drives, which I have not heard before.
So Winchester drives were drives where the read-write head and the disks were integrated in one piece.
Okay.
So, like, on an old mainframe style big washing machine type hard drive, you could take the disk bladders out and put new disk bladders in.
I see.
I believe that had to happen in a clean room, but I don't know for sure. The bits might have been big enough that the dust didn't matter. Yeah. These Bernoulli disks, just so you know, started out at 5, 10, and 20 megabytes, and they were about the size of a sheet of an A4 paper. So they're
pretty gigantic when you see him working with them. But he really makes a sales pitch. Like, he says you can just, like, ship them cross country without any special packing because they're that resilient that the data can't be damaged by going through the mail.
Well, yeah, I mean, there's no head to hit in the thing. So that's like, I don't know.
Just make sure there aren't any giant magnets in your shipping route.
I think this is interesting because it's the progenitor of the, like, there's a through line here through Zip and Jazz drives and SyQuest drives and all that.
Yes. Yeah. When I saw this, for sure. I guess that means every hard drive is a Winchester drive now, technically.
I think Winchester was a brand, but I mean, yeah.
But in terms of the design, I think they use that term generically even in this episode.
Yeah, that would make sense. I looked up Winchester discs, and the information that was easily available on that was a little thin.
Oh, it's actually named after the rifle.
Because apparently the cartridge and the...
Project head Kenneth Houghton named it after the Winchester 30-30 rifle because it was planned to have 2 30-megabyte spindles.
Wow.
The more you know.
Yeah. Well, turns out.
Yeah. This is a fun episode. I'm making air quotes. Well, let me rephrase that. If you were listening to this podcast, you probably consider this sort of thing fun too.
Can we talk about the game review at the end?
Yeah, we can touch on that. They definitely do their sort of, like, here's what's in the news this week, and here's somebody with a product review, and here's George Morrow doing his Andy Rooney thing, like we mentioned. Like, there's a lot of there's a grab bag of stuff at the end of every episode that we can touch on a little bit. But yes, they
the news segment, I did like the news segment that were like computer scientists feel that the computer requirements for Ronald Reagan's Star Wars program is impossible to create because we will never be able to test them outside of a wartime scenario.
Right. And also and, like hugely vulnerable to espionage and code theft.
Yeah. Huh.
That's,
weird.
Yeah. That stuff's wild.
Turned out to be right.
But yes, I don't remember who the software reviewer was, but he reviews this golden oldies pack in 1985 of golden oldie computer games.
It's incredible to me that we, his name is Paul Schindler. It's incredible to me that we're already in 1985 mining the nostalgia, hitting the nostalgia mines.
Yes.
For HD reissues. These aren't even HD reissues. It's just like, here's one place to buy five of these games. And the five games, look, in the history of games, these are, three of these are important, and one is Eliza.
Sure. Yeah. Arguably not even a game.
Not even a game, yeah. Adventure, Eliza, Pong, and the Game of Life. Also, maybe not even a game.
Yeah, Game of Life, more of a simulation, I guess I would call it.
But, like, this is noteworthy to me. It's funny to me because these four things are just like, well, I mean, until Flash went away yesterday, these four things are basically just, like, hey, things you can go find running on a website someplace in JavaScript.
Yeah.
Right?
Yes. Like, I started to wonder, this is $35 for the package from a company called Beverly Hills. Or I'm sorry.
I thought it was called Software Country in Beverly Hills.
I'm sorry, the way this was worded, I misread this. Yes, the company's name is Software Country from Beverly Hills, California. It made me wonder if they actually had the license to any of these. Or were they just shoveling them onto...
Oh, you think they were just repackaging them and selling them for $35?
Like, it would certainly not be the first time that happened in early software sales in the computing industry.
Also, it was like, $35 for Adventure, Eliza, Pong, and Game of Life in 1985, when $35 was an incredible amount of money.
Yes, I'm afraid I had to strongly disagree with their reviewer who said that was a fair price for this package.
I mean, I don't even know what floppy disks would have cost back then. I bet they were really expensive.
Yeah. Yes, probably. The 3.5 wasn't even on the market yet.
No, it was only 5.25 at that point.
Yeah.
Yeah. This is a weird time. It's really fun. I'm really enjoying going back in and digging into the time capsule and trying to the fun of this kind of episode of Computer Chronicles for me is picking up, like, doing enough research to figure out what the context is for the offhand comments that they're making in the background that are so common knowledge that they don't even need to provide context for. Because, like, one thing that Stuart is really good at is giving everybody the context that they need to understand what's going on if you understand the underlying technology. And some of the stuff is just, like, bonkers. Like, they talked about AT&T making a mobile display that is a 1-inch thick 4-pound plasma display for mobile computing.
That was just like a little aside in the news segment. It was like the last headline. It was just like AT&T has debuted a small plasma screen. And I'm like, dude, what? They're making plasmas in 1985? That's
they're
wild.
Probably monochrome. So,
sure. Okay.
Like,
sure.
Like if you, the first laptops I saw, even when I was in college, were still monochrome displays in 93.
Yeah.
And they were like TFTs that were reflective.
Right.
This would have been something that was the size of a suitcase, a 1-inch thick 4-pound display.
Yeah. Although, I mean, I guess that's fair. Like most kind of widespread technologies after they are widely adopted, when you go back and look at the history of them, they've like actually been around for 15 or 20 years, right? In conceptual form.
Well, or previous versions that didn't play ball for whatever reason.
Like, right, like they were too expensive to make or too big or didn't fully get there.
The fun thing about this is going back and looking at the other alternative paths that just disappeared. And just to be clear, I think every company mentioned in this episode, except for IBM and AT&T, no longer exists.
Yes, I believe that's right.
Priam, who is the hard drive, the people making the 16 megabyte hard drive that they talked to, got bought by a different company and then immediately disappeared.
Yes. I did a little digging, like Plus Development or whatever it was called, was a subsidiary of Quantum, which no longer exists.
Quantum got bought by Western Digital or Seagate or one of those companies in the early days of the mid 90s.
That's where
the
hard
drive consolidation.
Oh man, I remember the Quantum Fireball.
Quantum made a series of really weird drives. They made those Bigfoot 5.25-inch drives. that were like huge capacity but incredibly slow because the platters were so big. They made a hard disk clone for IBM XTs, was one of their earliest products. So it was like the slot that goes into the XT slot, and you have a hard drive on a card. Weird stuff.
Yep. These things are so fun. I think I only became aware of Computer Chronicles this past year. I'm pretty sure. Maybe
we talked about Computer Chronicles before we started doing the podcast. I'm pretty sure.
Maybe it's been a couple of years, but it's been very recently in my life that I had even heard of this show. I had no idea about it.
We didn't have a PBS. Our PBS station, we only got at specific times of day because it was coming from like, where was it? It was Channel 2 from, I want to say Smyrna or something, but it was a long way. So it only came in if the clouds were right, basically.
Nice.
And I don't think we would have gotten Computer Chronicles. I don't think it would have even aired where we were. They wouldn't have paid for it.
Definitely would not have in rural North Carolina. But yeah. I mean, it's one of the many great things about this thing is it was public television, so it's all just out there, right? Like archive.org and YouTube have every episode of the show over the like 20-plus year run.
I'm sure that's the result of somebody who worked on the show going in and uploading thousands of episodes of the show.
What I mean is it's not controlled by some large corporation who wants to sell you the archive or whatever. They're all just freely available.
Also, a lot of them came from
this particular episode on YouTube, because like you said, they're all just sort of uploaded by whoever.
Yeah.
Like this one has an incredible countdown from KCSM in San Mateo, San Francisco, the beginning of it.
Well, like these are probably the most, maybe it was somebody at the local home PBS station that uploaded it.
Like this is probably the tape they would have played to air or something.
Yeah, this is probably a rip of the tape that was played to air.
And then
this is uploaded by the Computer Chronicles YouTube channel. Like,
right. This is the official archive that they have. But that's what I mean, though, because they're just like harvesting this thing from old tapes. You get all these fun artifacts of broadcast, like that countdown with the most 80s ass looking motion graphics on it.
Well, and I love like when Stuart does the intro in what looks like a proto data center or something someplace, he probably just went over to like, you know, HP or whoever it happened to be at the time.
I didn't think about that. Every time I watch this, they've got so much B-roll of like you said, like factories and data centers and you name it. And well, I guess if they were in the valley, like they're right in the middle of all of that, right?
Yeah, this stuff was all still being built there, right? It's not like they were shipping designs to China and then Foxconn was making them for them at this point. This was like, you know, people were converting all those. This is why those campuses in the valley are so big.
Yeah.
Anyway,
it's a fun show. I guess let us know what you think of this format. If this is something that you would like to hear semi-regularly, because I certainly love watching this show. It's just
if you have episodes you love, or if you have magazine issues, like there's like I want to go through one of the old end of year Computer Shopper issues where they had like 500 pages of Computer Shopper.
Yeah. The show is just like a warm blanket to me. So if people are into this, then please let us know. Cause I don't know. Makes me feel good every time I watch one of these.
Yeah. And corrections last week, I conflated the polio vaccine with the invention of vaccines, which meant the creation of the first vaccine last week was off by, I don't know, a couple hundred years. My bad.
The very nerve.
I know. Well,
to do so. Well, so actually a couple hundred years is a pretty big margin of error, to be fair.
4,000 years of recorded history. 200 years is not great. Yeah. Jenner did the smallpox vaccine non-consensually, it seems, by giving a bunch of children, exposing them to the weak version or dead version of the smallpox. Anyway, sorry about that. We regret the error and we'll endeavor to do better in the future.
Yes.
We did not have a flu vaccine in 1918, though. So
no, certainly not.
And I guess that'll do it for us this week, Brad.
Yeah, it was fun. It's a good way to start off. Here we are on New Year's Day. It's a nice way to start off 2021.
21. Oh, right. It's the good year.
Let's hope.
Fingers are crossed, man. I feel good about it.
We're not that far removed from the bad year yet, so I'm not going to make any early predictions.
Spare.
Let's hope.
This is the part of the show where we thank our wonderful patrons. for supporting the Tech Pod. And if you would like to find out how you can support the Tech Pod, you can do that by going to patreon.com/techpod. And for a couple of bucks a month, you can gain access to the fabulous Tech Pod Discord, which we, I think, mentioned earlier in the episode even. But I want to make an extra special thanks to our executive producer level patrons, the Bunny Fiend, Jacob Chappell, Andrew Cotton, David Allen, and James Kamick. Thank you all so much for supporting the show.
Yes, thank you.
And you all are awesome. Please let us know if you. Thanks to everybody who supports the show, not just the executive producers.
Totally.
We're just talking before we started about some plans for 2021, and I think we have some exciting stuff coming.
Yeah. Some fun ideas.
Yeah,
such as maybe watch more Computer Chronicles.
Well, I mean, that's one of them.
It's more
for
ambitious
sure
than that.
Look, one of the challenges is that the episodes that are real research heavy, like I want to do an episode about HDMI, all the pitfalls of the current HDMI world.
Ugh.
But like, I don't have a TV that supports the newest HDMI stuff, so I can't actually just test it myself.
Right.
And the amount of hardware that's out there that supports that stuff in different levels is really broad.
It is a mess right now.
But like, I was talking to a friend. We had this conversation in a different Discord with a friend. I had a conversation with a friend 2 days ago, and he was like, you know, I never plugged in the USB cables from my soundbar to my TV. And I was like, oh, that means you probably don't have HDR. And he's like, really? And I was like, yeah. And he plugged it in. He's like, yeah, we plugged it in and then watched Thor Ragnarok or Wonder Woman or something. And we're like, oh my God, this looks so much better. So he's had this expensive ass OLED for 2 years.
It's a tale as old as time.
Yeah. Anyways. But those episodes take an incredible amount of time to research and cover all the bases. So we were looking for some things that are that we can do, you know, that a little more easily repeatable than those for the in-between episodes. So
yes.
And if you have ideas for that stuff, send them in too. The email address is techbot@content.town. But thank you all so much. And we will see you next week.
Thank you, everybody. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. Bye, everybody.